It's time for Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. Welcome to our podcast featuring Adam Awesome, writer for the weekly publication Current in Carmel. You can access his writing online at currentincarmel.com. I'm Larry Lannon. I write a local news Fishers blog, larryinfishers.com. This week, Adam and I will review two films. Both are on the multiplexes around town now, Dunkirk and The Big Sick. Our guest featured later in this program is Justin Mack of the Indianapolis Star. Now let's go to the movies. Once again, at Donatello's Restaurant in downtown Carmel, and I must tell you that my wife and I availed ourselves of the food at Donatello's last week, and my wife can be a tough critic, and she loved the place.
I'm glad she did.
So we will probably return at some point. We're going to talk about two films today that have come out recently, and the first one is Dunkirk. Now, the big difference between you and I here is that I watched it in standard video, or not standard video, but a standard film.
You watched it on a
production.
Phone. You had a bootleg that you watched on a cell phone.
Well, let's not give our secrets out. No, actually, I did pay what they call standard film watching today. You saw it at the IMAX big 3D.
In 70 millimeter.
70 millimeter.
Which I think Chicago doesn't have that, and I think Indiana or Indianapolis might be one of the few places in the Midwest to see it in this format, which very few films are filmed in this format.
And you got the chance to do that. So maybe we'll kind of compare and contrast how we saw that. This film was directed and written by Christopher Nolan. One thing that struck me about this film, just to tell you what it's about before I get into that, this goes back to May of 1940, and this was a very dark time for the United Kingdom. Germany had advanced all the way through most of Western Europe. It was about to completely occupy France, trapping the Allied troops on the beaches of Dunkirk. Dunkirk, of course, right there in France on the English Channel. And the British troops that were there, they were retreating and they were trying to get back to Britain. This was no small thing. We're talking 330,000, roughly, French and British troops that were trying to get back to the United Kingdom. They were under constant bombardment by the Luftwaffe, which is the air force of the Nazi German regime. But there were Spitfires up there from the British Air Force, fighting those Luftwaffe pilots and planes. So the big challenge was, how does the British military get these troops through the English Channel, which is no small thing. It's a pretty rough set of seas, by the way. So what basically happened is that the British commandeered all of the pleasure boats along that channel to try to get these troops back to Britain. They were basically British, Belgian, and Dutch soldiers, as well as the French. One thing that struck me about this film, and it tried to tell the story of Dunkirk occasionally at the large level, but for the most part, it was told through the stories of individual people trying to deal with it, troops and the pleasure boat owner and pilots. What struck me about this film, Adam, before I'll have you weigh in on it, is that there is not a ton of dialogue in this film. It's a lot, but not as much as you'd find in most films. This film really focused on what was happening at Dunkirk and how terrible it was for the people who were sitting through it and living through it and dying through it in some cases. I thought it was a compelling film simply because of the way it told that story and the way it used the technology available to filmmakers today to make you feel like you were right in the middle of that battle. You were a pilot, or you really were one of those troops trying to get across the English Channel. I mean, that's what struck me about it. Again, I saw it in the standard format. You saw it in the big 70-millimeter 3D big screen format. So tell me your impressions of the film.
I think you're absolutely right. There is very little dialogue in this film. That's a common takeaway from people who see this movie. And in that vein, I'd compare it to the film we reviewed last week, War for the Planet of the Apes, where I really enjoyed Dunkirk. would not recommend it to everyone because it is low on dialogue. It is a slower-paced film. So if you like Christopher Nolan because you liked Interstellar, Inception, or the Dark Knight movies, you might be disappointed in this. But I think most film buffs who can appreciate it will really appreciate what he's done here. What he really did was take a small story and tell it with a big movie. This isn't a movie about all of the war. This isn't a movie about giant troops battling other troops. It isn't even a movie about fighting each other. It's a film of survival, and which is really interesting because you don't see that in a lot of World War II movies. At the end of the film, and this was historically accurate, Winston Churchill said, you know, this is a victory, but we have to be careful. This was a retreat. They weren't heading into battle. They were running away from the enemy. But it was very important because if these British troops weren't able to safely get back across the channel, they would have lost most of the British army, if not all. The big heart of it was there, something like 400,000 soldiers. And they were, you know, not very optimistic. They were thinking, well, maybe we can get a third of that or 25% of that back and we'll be able to kind of survive. Well, because of the heroic acts of average people stepping up in war, the majority of those troops were saved. I thought that it was technically brilliant. It was amazing to see on the big IMAX screen. When I saw Dark Knight Rises, another Christopher Nolan film, part of that was shot in IMAX. So it wasn't taken and turned in IMAX. It was shot in IMAX, which meant for select scenes in that action movie, it went to full screen. If you've been to the IMAX theater at the State Museum, it's not one of those fake IMAX theaters where it's just kind of a big screen. This is a three-story, you almost fall off the chairs trying to go up that really steep staircase
right
up there.
You see it best when you're in the middle or toward the top. If you're really close, you don't get the full feeling of those IMAX films.
But this film, it was interesting because I thought, okay, well, some scenes are going to use the full screen. 90% of the movie used the full screen. It was actually kind of interesting that there were a few scenes that didn't, and I thought, well, you do reshoots, stuff like that. I understand, you know, there's going to be times you can't do everything in IMAX, but this might be one of the best uses of IMAX in a major movie. I'd put it up there with Gravity and Avatar in the use of IMAX, and unlike those, this isn't a 3D film. So you feel like you're
there.
That's
right. I forgot that's not in 3D, is it?
Yeah.
But it's in 70 millimeter.
But
okay,
you know what?
Difference.
Even with, I liked it better because sometimes those glasses can drive you nuts. They can hurt your eyes. But this, you didn't need 3D. It was all around you. You felt like you were there. And that was also, I think, important for the storytelling because having the feeling like you're there moment also played into the, you know, feeling like you're on the boat, feeling like you're on Tom Hardy's airplane going around. So I think it was a very good movie. I'm going to make a bold prediction. I'm going to predict now, we'll see if I'm right, that this will be one of the nominees for Best Picture. I'm not saying it's going to win, but if there are 9 or 10 nominees, I feel like this will fit the big, epic war film, you know, those kind of big movies like Hacksaw Ridge last year, and I think it'll be one of the nominees.
The whole Oscar thing is strange to me, excuse me, when you bring that up, because there are two steps. You know, there's the entire Academy that votes on who wins, but before that, who will be the nominees, that's a smaller group of people, and they usually are a little more attuned to what's going on. So, I hate to say it, some people in the Academy, some watch all the films, some don't. That's why they have these huge marketing campaigns within the L.A. area where a lot of them live. Though some of them are scattered, most of them still live in that area where most of the filmmaking is done. But I say that because I do believe there's an excellent chance that Dunkirk will receive an Oscar nomination, possibly for Best Picture. But I'll tell you one thing. I do fully expect a lot of technical Oscar nominations. That this is a technical masterpiece, and they use that technology to make you feel like you're one of these people. You're one of the pleasure boat owners that helps save all these troops. You are the pilot up in the airplane who's performing near miracles in that Spitfire aircraft that the British had. One aspect of this film that was very interesting, most war films in recent years will show both sides. They would show the Germans, they would show the Allies. In this film, you never see a German person. You never see the German side of it. It's all about those people who are on the beach at Dunkirk trying to evacuate. And I think that was a masterful stroke, because that's the way that film was worked. They wanted to put you in their minds and their bodies and to see the things that they saw. And, you know, the survivors and some who didn't survive, you know, watching that whole thing go on. So, yeah, it's got an Oscar buzz for a reason. And I did it because it was a masterful part of a piece of filmmaking by using that technology the way it should be used to make you feel like you're there and you are feeling what those characters are feeling.
And I saw some criticisms of the film, and this goes back to what we talked about with War of the Planet of the Apes. But at least that had a lot of story to it, even though you had to pay attention. Some people said that they thought this was all style, no substance. I can understand that criticism because it is a very stylish movie. It is about atmosphere. It's about feeling. It's about making you feel like you're there, as opposed you really don't have a lot of explanation of what's going on. And if you aren't familiar with the historical event, you may feel a little lost at the beginning, even though there is a little crawl. But somebody pointed something interesting. At the end of the film, you know, usually war movies will always put the text on the screen of this many people survived, this happened. There was none of that in this movie.
That's correct.
Yeah. It was a lot of, you know, watch this, feel this. If you want to learn more, you can go Google it later, but we're not going to have long things of dialogue explaining everything that's happening in the war. It was a very good film. I don't know if I would rush to see it again right away because, I mean, it's pretty emotionally draining.
I felt that way, too. I walked out of that theater and thinking, wow, I feel like I've just been through it myself. And that's a tip of the hat to the filmmaker. I understand where some of that criticism is coming from. I understand that. But I think you have to go back and look at what the filmmakers were trying to do. And I think Mr. Nolan got it done. And for that reason, I think it's a good film. Whether it should be an Oscar nominee, we can have that debate. I think it should be in the running. But, of course, we don't know what other films are going to really hit the mark later in the year. We know what's going to be released most likely between now and the end of the year, although those decisions can change sometimes by the studios. But we do know that this film is going to be in the running.
And don't let it fool you just because you'll see Harry Styles of One Direction as one of the actors in the film. I didn't even know he was in the movie until I saw the credits at the end. So
you won't recognize
him. No. Yeah. So, I mean, he must have done a good job then. So
we're going to talk about one other film in this particular segment, and we'll be talking to Justin Mack here in a few minutes about his favorite films. But we're going to talk about The Big Sick. Now, The Big Sick is a film about... I don't know, when I saw The Big Sick, and I just saw it last night with my wife, we were talking about it afterwards, and in a strange way, and in, not in every way, but in a strange way, it goes back and reminds me, and I'm old enough to remember when this first came out, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? Much more comic than that, and tells the story in a much more comical fashion, but it was about a daughter bringing an African-American man home to meet her parents, and you know, Spencer Tracy, Audrey Hepburn, that's a classic film. But this one is about Middle East, about Pakistani people, where in Pakistan it is the tradition that the mother and father choose the spouse of the child. And usually it's the son who their parent will bring in the women to meet, quote unquote, the son. And, you know, they basically they don't tell you who to marry, but they kind of give you the pool of who you should marry. That's their custom in Pakistan and in many Middle Eastern countries. So this is a story that stars Kumail Nanjiani.
Kumail Nanjiani.
Kumail Nanjiani. I always mispronounce his name. Kumail Nanjiani. And he's a well-known comic, and he's made a name for himself that way. But this is it's based on a true story. I'm sure they may have had fun with it. But he and his wife wrote this, and he basically is telling the story of how he met his wife, courted his wife, had big trouble with his wife as far as accepting him because his Pakistani parents were having trouble accepting the fact that he would be involved with any woman who was not a Pakistani woman. So it's told in a hilarious way. There are some very serious moments in this film. I'm not going to give away too much as to what happens, but it tells a very, very interesting story. There's illness involved. There's parental relationships. There are great people in this film. Zoe I hope I pronounce it Kazan. Kazan, I hope I pronounced her name. Zoe Kazan plays Emily. He played himself, but his wife didn't play herself. I assume she didn't want
to. She helped write the screenplay, though.
But she didn't. Yeah, she didn't want to play herself on the screen. She did help write it, of course. But I'll tell you who stole the show. It's Emily's father, played by Ray Romano.
He was fantastic.
He stole the show. Holly Hunter was very good. Don't get me wrong. She plays the mom, and she does her job. And I just thought Ray Romano comically stole that show in The Big Sick. It's hard to do comedy. You know, and I think it's sad that the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences does not give comedies their due. They rarely get nominations. They rarely get attention. But talk to somebody who writes, somebody who acts, somebody who directs. They'll tell you that comedy is the hardest thing to do in film or theater. The timing has to be perfect. It just has to be absolutely great. This film pulled it off. It was a very funny film. As I said, not everything's funny. It's a bit melodramatic at times, but for a good part of the film, it can almost be farcical at times. And it's based on a true story, but they had a lot of fun with it. You know, Kamel is trying to make it as a stand-up comic. Emily wants to be an analyst. She's going for her master's. They meet in Chicago. They have a romance. Then the romance breaks off. She's upset about the fact that he's got this problem with his Pakistani parents. And then there's an illness that happens and starts to change everything. So I just thought the film was funny. It was supposed to be funny. It was funny. And so in that sense, I think it was a very good film. So where I would give Dunkirk a B, I would also give The Big Sick a B, maybe a B minus, as just being a really enjoyable film to watch. And it really tries to have some fun with this whole issue of race relations, not black and white, but Middle Eastern and white.
I thought it was a fantastic film. I probably would rank it higher than you. Okay. I might give it, I mean, for what it was trying to do, it was probably an A, because it's not trying to be an Oscar-winning movie. It's trying to be a romantic comedy. And it's one of the best romantic comedies I've seen in years because it's so rooted in truth. This is a true story of how Kumail Nanjiani and his wife, Emily Gordon, kind of got together. And they host a podcast together where they talk about video games and stuff. So they have a lot of chemistry, him and his wife. So a lot of people are already familiar with them. He's a stand-up comedian who will talk about his life growing up in Pakistan, and you might know him from the TV show Silicon Valley, where he plays a different version of himself, but kind of another nerdy character, which he always seems to play. But this film had a lot of little moments that were funny. It wasn't, you know, slapstick humor. It wasn't gross-out humor. And although there were a few F-bombs and there were a few lewd jokes, it wasn't, you know, the kind of Seth Rogen kind of style raunchy humor. It was truth in humor, which I really appreciated. I thought Ray Romano was fantastic. There was one scene between him and Kumail kind of in the, not to give anything away, but the title Big Sick, you know, someone gets sick. So they're there in the hospital and they're kind of having a conversation. And it was edgy with still having heart, had a lot of humor to it. I really appreciated the movie. Directed by a kind of a fellow newcomer director, Michael Showalter. Now, if that name sounds familiar, he was in the MTV sketch comedy show The State, which wasn't a great TV show, but actually spawned a lot of great actors and directors like David Wayne and Thomas Lennon and Joe Latrullio, Ken Marino, Michael Ian Black, a lot of those people. So the guys from like Reno 911 or Wet Hot American Summer, they all came from that comedy troupe. He directed a previous film called Hi, My Name is Doris, starring Sally Field, which was kind of a quieter indie comedy that didn't get a lot of acclaim, but was pretty good. And he does a great job with this by not making it too big. He keeps it subtle, keeps it rooted in reality. And actually, in a comedy, great direction is when you don't notice it, when you kind of just feel like you're just there. So I would give this film high marks. And although I think Dunkirk blew me away probably more than this film, I'd probably recommend The Big Sick to more people. I think it has a wide appeal because I could see my parents or grandparents enjoying the film, and I can see my younger sister enjoying the film because I think it has something to tell for different age groups and different audiences.
Very true. All that is very true. I mean, I don't want to people to think I don't like The Big Sick. I do. I just think Dunkirk's in a little bit different plane. And I give it a B-. I still like a film at a B-. And the reason I give it that's because it's not a big film. And it really, and that is one of its strengths. The fact that that it talks about stand-up comedy as well as personal relationships. If you've ever known somebody to do stand-up comic work, they'll tell you the most effective piece of material they can have is something people can relate to in their personal lives. You know, something about relationships, something about parenting, growing up. If you can tell jokes that people can understand in that part of their life, that's going to be the best set for you. And that's what they do in this film. They talk about relations. It's complicated by, you know, nationalities and the Middle East culture and all that, but it's still at its root about relationships between people.
I used to do some open mic stand-up comedy back in the day.
Okay, secret's out.
Yeah, it wasn't, I mean, I wasn't that great, but it was, you give you 3 to 5 minutes, you really can't talk about your life as much. You're kind of telling jokey jokes, and you haven't found your persona yet, and you kind of see that in Kumail's character, where when he gets up and does stand-up, instead of talking about his family and his life, because there's a lot of material there that he uses in his actual stand-up in real life, but his character in the movie is making kind of pun jokes and stuff like that, and as a result, he's not proceeding. And you see he has a kind of a one-man show in the movie, where, you know, he talks about Pakistan all the time, but then his girlfriend says, yeah, I learned a lot about Pakistan, but I didn't learn a lot about you.
That was a great line from the film. I was about to use that, and you beat me to it. So, yes, that was a great moment in the film. You know, I saw your one-man show, and it really shows how he, as a stand-up comic, struggled at first and started to find his rhythm, and Emily sort of helped him do that. But, you know, I want to know about you. I don't want to know all about Pakistan. Don't tell me about your history. Tell me about Pakistan and you, how it affected you as you were growing up. And that's what he did. And that became a successful one. He was pruning that one-man show, and all of his friends were saying, oh, yeah, I liked it. Yeah. Then you know you're in trouble. But, no, I like The Big Sick. I would recommend people see it. Dunkirk, you're pretty much on target. It may not be a film for everyone. It's not a World War, it's the old-fashioned World War II film. And even if you go back to the earlier part of the 20th century, there were a few films about World War I, not many. All Quiet on the Western Front is one that you might, it comes up every now and then on cable TV. That sort of shows you how people were thinking of war at that time. The World War II films, the films that came out of that were, how should I put that, the cleaned-up version of war. It didn't tell you a lot of the really awful things. Dunkirk is not afraid to get you into the head of the soldier, the pilot, the pleasure boat owner, you know, called into service to help out. You get their personal story. They don't ignore the overall crisis that was going on. And Kenneth Branham, what's his name? Kenneth.
Right now, yeah. The.
Kenneth.
Yeah, Kenneth Branagh, you know, the Shakespearean actor.
Yeah, Branagh. Yeah. I'm mispronouncing names today.
You can tell okay.
I'm a mess. But Kenneth Branagh, it doesn't have a big part in the film, but he's there every now and then as one of the top generals, you know, giving the overall idea what's going on. Then you go back to the individual stories. He'll come back in and say, okay, things are still bad. Oh, my goodness, we're going to have to do this. But at the very end, he does something interesting, which I won't reveal because it's part of the end of the film. But his character sort of weans together all the things happening overall while you're still getting what it feels like to be in one of those ships that's going down, and you're in the ocean, and you're trying to be rescued. I mean, I've heard people describe that to me, veterans of World War II, and what I felt in that film dovetails what stories I heard from those men.
I think if you look at great World War II movies, let's take out Holocaust movies, because, I mean, those are definitely World War II movies, but films like Schindler's List and The Pianist, and we'll set those aside as kind of a different category. Usually you talk as the best one they would consider would be Saving Private Ryan, because Steven Spielberg did a great technical job showing the invasion of Normandy, but there were a lot of things that historians criticized about that film. Some of the narrative was completely fabricated, kind of telling them looking for this soldier, and they felt like it focused so much on the American troops when actually the Americans at Normandy were a small percentage compared to the British or even the Canadian troops that were there.
Since you mentioned that, there was criticism of Dunkirk from people in India because there were Indian troops that were a part of this, and nobody mentioned them in the film. So you're always going to have the danger of leaving somebody out and somebody being felt like they've been passed by. But as a filmmaker, you got to think about what works, and maybe that would have been too many facts to give people, and so the filmmakers have to make a decision on that. So I'm glad, you know, we've had some really good films to review here in recent weeks, and Dunkirk and The Big Sick, I think, are right up there as very good films. And I would, for most people, I would say go see Dunkirk, and I think The Big Sick has a very wide swath of an audience that would appeal to.
See anything else recently, Larry?
Well, I was going to ask you a question here. Tell me this. We're going to ask this of Justin Mack when he comes on here a little later. We're more than halfway through the year. So with that in mind, talk about your favorite film you have seen, best film you have seen up to this time this year.
It's hard to say.
I'll give you mine while you're thinking about it. The film that really, and I think it's this year, I hope I've got my timing wrong, because I seem to be mispronouncing things today. Get Out is the name of the film. I thought Get Out was the best film I have seen this year. And the reason I like the film is, well, two reasons. Number one is that it's great at misdirection. You think you're going in one direction, and all of a sudden, the film takes you in a completely different direction you don't see coming. And it's hard for a director to do that. He does it effectively. And it also deals with the whole racial stereotyping issue. And it looks at it not just from blacks looking at whites, but black people it looks at it both ways, black, white, white, black. And it tries to attack some of the stereotypes that we have, misconceptions we have about people. And the interesting part of that film, and I won't give it away for those who may be streaming it or watching it in some other way other than a theater right now, coming up here. But there were two different endings to that film. And the ending that I expected, and I won't say any more than that, the ending that I expected is the one the director chose not to use. The ending I did not expect is the one that happened. So if you ever see the film, just think about the ending and how you thought it was going to end and how it really did end. And I think it just ties into this whole idea of our racial relationships in America today, which is a very complicated thing. And I think this director and the writers of that film gave everybody something compelling to think about as they walk
Jordan
out of the theater.
Jordan Peele from the comedy troupe Key and Peele
right. Did
a great job with that film. I enjoyed it as well. I thought that it was very suspenseful more than scary. It wasn't really a horror film. I know it's kind of built as that as some.
Well, there's an aspect to that, but it's not the main thing.
It's more of a thriller.
Yeah, I would agree.
But it kept you on suspense. And what I really liked about it was, you know, me and you see a lot of movies. It's hard to be surprised sometimes because when you see so many movies, you know what's going to happen. You know, did I like Spider-Man Homecoming? Yeah. Was I surprised by it? Not necessarily. You know, I know that he's going to win. I know, you know, all the plot points they're going to go through. It's still enjoyable.
Well, they did throw a couple of surprises at you, but there was not a lot of thriller type activity in there.
But I always enjoy a movie where I'm watching it thinking, I don't know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. And I think I really felt that with Get Out. I kind of felt a little that with and I'm not going to overhype it, but Logan was a very good superhero movie, reinventing it with some great performances by Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart. Gets a little too violent, drags a little bit pace-wise, but it does a few things that are, you know, really commendable. I enjoyed the fun action of Kong Skull Island just because the visuals, the World War II, and, you know, who can not like Samuel L. Jackson and John C. Reilly in a role? I enjoyed War for the Planet of the Apes. You know, guilty pleasure, John Wick 2 was kind of fun. I don't know if I'd recommend that to everyone. I say guilty pleasure, but it was definitely enjoyable to see. But there haven't been a lot of great dramatic films out because we haven't hit that period yet, the Oscar films. So if I were to make my top 10 films right now, it'd be a lot of superhero action movies. But they really wouldn't have all of the prestige films that we're going to see later in the year. One film, though, I will throw in as... this may sound weird that I'm saying this, but I thought this film was great. The new Beauty and the Beast was really well done. And I came from the age group that when that came out, it was probably like 94, 93 something. I was in elementary school, so of course we saw it. We knew all the songs. It was really not a boy or a girl movie, but all kids liked that film. And when they redid it with a live action aspect, they wanted to keep enough aspects of the original that had the nostalgia for people our age, but make a few things new and fresh that it wasn't a complete retread. And from that perspective, they did a fantastic job. The unfortunate thing is it'll make Disney want to remake every one of their movies, which I already hear they're already trying to do a live action Lion King with like motion capture lions with Donald Glover playing Simba. And then they also want to do Aladdin, which they had some trouble with because they're having trouble casting. And of course, there were a lot of jokes like, just cast Ryan Gosling as Aladdin. You know you want to do it.
Funny.
You know you want to do it, Disney. Just put Ryan Gosling in the role.
Well, you know, when you're an executive with one of the big studios, you're looking at where the pile of money is.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Disney does see that pile of money there. And if it's there, they'll try it, and we'll see if it works. Now, we've talked, you're much more of a fan of remakes than I am. I think
I don't hate them as much.
Well, I don't say I hate them. I wish for new ideas. I think The Big Sick is an original film. You know, it doesn't fit some of the formula, and it's not a remake. So at least, you know, they're trying to come up with some different ideas. A Pakistani and a man and a white woman trying to have a relationship where it gets complicated. I think that is nice. When Hollywood tries to get creative and different, they can do wonderful things. They can fall on their face too. But when remakes just become too often, they're there too much, and there's so little new material coming out, that's when I get a little frustrated.
One of the most underrated films of this year, 2017 now, that we've seen so far is Split. It was a psychological thriller by M. Night Shyamalan, who kind of was at high peaks early in his career with The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable, and then kind of fell to the point where his films were critically hated and were bombing at the box office. Films like After Earth with Will Smith that cost like 200 something million and made like 20 million because nobody wanted to see it and everyone thought it was garbage. Well, now he's coming back with smaller films on smaller budgets that are more story driven.
Mm-hmm.
And the film Split is really a lot of fun. It's James McAvoy, who's a very talented actor, playing kind of the bad guy who kidnaps this young girl from a parking lot, and he has multiple personality disorder. And so she's locked in this room with these other girls, and they're trying to escape, and they don't know which personality is going to come into the room to address them. And then all the different personalities are kind of conspiring with each other, and he's playing the different characters. He plays a little kid, he plays a woman, and there's kind of a therapist who's kind of do it. So is it out there? Yeah. Did I have a lot of fun watching that movie? Yes, I did. And you know what? Everyone I've talked to this scene to, they said, hey, you know what? I kind of enjoyed it. I think I was going to. So underrated film for 2017. If you want a nice psychological thriller, Split is a good one to see.
You just got back from Washington, D.C. Some of your favorite tourist activity while you were out there?
Well, we went to the Smithsonian because we're kind of short on time. My brother has a... Him and his wife have a child that's less than a year old, so we spent a lot of time with her. But when we did, we went and saw the Natural History Museum, the American History Museum, the National Gallery of Art. We went to some nice dinners, and then we went to go see a concert for Ben Folds and Regina Spektor at the Wolf Trap, which is a wonderful venue. It's kind of like Deer Creek, but cooler because it's out in a national park.
And you still call it Deer Creek.
I did say Deer Creek, didn't I? Hey, you know what? I'm sticking by it. I'm going to say Deer Creek.
Many people will still call that venue Deer Creek from now on. So I just thought that was interesting. Every time I get to go to D.C., and I've been there for once the last few years, I'm always on a legislative conference where somebody else is paying for it, or I'm there on business. And someday I'm going to go to D.C. where I can just be a tourist and go out and see all these museums. But all right, we're going to be back next week with another film, and we will be back in just a few moments to talk with Justin Mack. This is Hamilton County Goes to the Movies. Our podcast originates each week from Donatello's Italian Restaurant, 9 West Main Street, in the downtown Carmel Arts and Design District. Next time you go to Donatello's, ask about Adam's latest gelato creation. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Contact us about this podcast at our email address, HamiltonCountyGoesToTheMovies@gmail.com. That's HamiltonCountyGoesToTheMovies@gmail.com. Now let's talk with this week's guest. Back with Hamilton County Goes to the Movies, we have our guest today, and Adam will do the introduction duties.
All right, we have Justin Mack today from the Indianapolis Star. A lot of, from the digital platform, he hosts, it's a daily show called The Drop. It's kind of like Indianapolis's version of The Daily Show, where he takes today's news and puts his humorous spin on it. He's a Cleveland native. He's a big fan of comic books and movies. And if you follow him on social media, you know this guy goes to see a lot of movies. So we thought he'd be a good guest today to talk about some of his favorites. Welcome, Justin.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you with us today. Since you are such a fan of film, you must be really happy because the comic book genre in movies is really riding high these days.
This is like, you know, nirvana for, you know, someone who grew up on all that stuff, comics and video games and manga and anime, and figured, you know, we'd never get around to a point where not only would this be even acceptable in a lot of places, but most of the biggest adaptations you see are either from comic books, or if not from comic books, almost that kind of geek culture fiction. Think about stuff like Ready Player One that's getting ready to come out, and The Hunger Games, and stuff like that. You know, Harry Potter. This is stuff that was, you know, geek culture that's being adapted into the biggest money makers in film. And seeing it on screen is awesome. It's tough because some of the adaptations, as a purist, are hard to watch when they butcher things that you love. But at the same time, at least we're getting a shot. And 9 times out of 10, they seem to be getting it right more often than not.
Now, as a kid growing up in the 60s, I was actually on the downhill slide of the DC comics with Batman, Superman, Aquaman, and all those other things. And it just irks me that how could the movie makers mess up Batman versus Superman as badly as they did?
I have no idea. Well, they forgot why Superman... Well, mainly they missed Superman. I'm not even a huge Superman fan, but the things that made him a beloved character and an endearing character, they nailed with, you know, Christopher Reeve and everything. But they forgot that and turned him into this, you know, gloomy and doomy scowling guy. In the comic book, Superman always has a little bit of an edge that he can be a jerk because if he wanted to, he could throw everyone into the sun that powers him. But he didn't do that because of the goodness in his heart, Ma and Pa Kent. And now this Superman's just bummed out all the time. And I won't even get into how they just destroyed Batman. In my Mount Rushmore of comic book heroes, Batman is squarely on there. It's one of my top four. And world's greatest detective, one of the smartest guys in any room he's in. Yet he let some version of Lex Luthor, played by, I love the guy to death.
Jesse Eisenberg?
Yeah, he's not.
Big Pacer fan right there.
Oh, God. Yeah, and this, you know, adolescent Lex managed to outsmart Batman into fighting a battle that Batman should have been smart enough to know that he shouldn't be going to fight yet. They turned Batman into a rage demon and Superman into a brooding bummer. Thank God that Wonder Woman was there to make me smile at least once or twice in the film. Because, again, they just took everything we loved about the characters and Zack Snyder said, no, forget that. I want to try and make Superhero 300, and it just didn't work out. So hopefully they'll fix it. I'm a huge Flash fan as well, so the fact that, you know, they're going to get a chance to... He's a character you can't mess up. He's just a fun guy who runs fast and cracks jokes. DC's Spider-Man. But if they manage to mess up Batman and Superman, I don't have hope. I like Ezra Miller. He's also not Barry Allen, but I'll give him a pass.
All right, well, let's go back a little bit to learn a bit about you and kind of who you are and kind of what movies that you like. Now, first off, I described you as kind of the Daily Show for Indy. Are you more Trevor Noah or Jon Stewart, more John Oliver? What do you think you are?
Let's see. I like to think of myself as like a better-looking Jon Stewart with a little bit more of the current cred of almost the guys on SNL, but, you know, Colin Jost not messing up stuff and Michael Che not laughing at all of his own jokes. So that's kind of where I put myself, and also better dressed than all those guys as well.
Now, being here in Hamilton County, you've made a few jokes about some Hamilton County cities.
Absolutely.
Carmel's been a good punchline for you every once in a while.
Hey, man, shout out to the homie Jim Brainerd, man. He always gives us something fun to talk about. And it's a good thing. He's busy. He's always doing a lot. I know, just recently on the drop, we talked about all his expansion plans, and every week he's got a new development that he wants to launch, and I think it's fantastic because it always gives me something to make a little bit fun of. But I love it. It's great. He's a great guy, great city.
Yeah, those of us in Fishers are playing catch-up right now, so we're nowhere near
the...
We
got IKEA. IKEA, that's
we
big.
We do have IKEA.
Oh, my gosh, I'm going to be there all the time. Well, between that and Topgolf opening up and mm-hmm. just stuffing my face full of Portillo's, it's going to be a great time to be up there as well.
And there's also going to be a movie theater mm-hmm. as part of the yard development, mm-hmm. and it looks like it's going to be one of those dining type of venues, but I push people. They don't know what kind of the cinema is going to be in there. They don't know if it'll be the regular Hollywood type mm-hmm. or they'll do something a little different. But so we'll have more movies to watch, more places to watch films, because strange as it may sound, Fishers does not have a movie theater.
Oh, right.
There's one right across 96th Street, and there's one up in there's several up in Noblesville, but we don't have one in Fishers.
Four Flicks Brewhouse mm-hmm. in Carmel. I mean, it's close, but technically in Westfield, you had to go up to the Regal there. Although I love Flicks because, you know, you get the food's pretty affordably priced, mm-hmm. and then, you know, usually you don't find as many people talking during the movies because they got food in their mouth,
yeah.
so it's not as bad. Because talking during movies, that always drives me nuts.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's kind of a tricky to navigate. I know, like, the actual food at movie theaters, Flicks, and the Studio Movie yeah. Grill, those are things now. But at the same time, you got people trying to tip their servers and
oh, yeah.
bring, you know... Some movies start off right away with a bang. Imagine a new 007 that historically starts off with an amazing scene. In the beginning, I got people rattling through and opening their Foster's beer cans and all that stuff. Just be quiet. Get your popcorn eaten before James Bond does something awesome.
Well, when I went and saw Batman vs. Superman, I think the best part was they had a special beer tied in with the movie. So my review was, and the movie was but you know, they had this handcrafted beer that they made that was tied in like a kryptonite, kind of key lime ale, and man, nice. That was good. The movie, but you know.
Well, tell us, Justin, we know about your tendency to like the comic book characters, but with that in mind, tell us about some of your favorite films of all time.
Well, my favorite films, and my first, what I always say, what's your favorite film? The first one that comes to mind is, I think, good for this discussion, because when I say favorite films, I don't necessarily mean best films,
mm-hmm.
because one of my first favorite films isn't even this director's best film, in my opinion. Tarantino's one of my favorites of all time. Pulp Fiction is a far better movie. Kill Bill was a far better, cooler movie, but my favorite Tarantino film will always be Reservoir Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not the best directed or the best acted movie in his stable of movies, but my favorite. And just because it had so much personality, because beyond the heist and all the, you know, the gangster stuff that they were doing, my favorite part of the movie was just the conversations they had in between shooting people and running from the cops. And that was what made that movie always stick out to me when I first saw it, when I was way too young to be watching that movie. But, like, you know, the opening scene where Steve Buscemi's railing about why he doesn't tip, or mm-hmm. Tarantino's giving a very inappropriate, you know, explanation of the real meaning behind a Madonna song. Or even, you know, K. Billy's songs of the 70s playing on the radio and every transition they make. It was like these guys who were doing something that is unspeakable for most people, committing crimes, blah, blah, blah. But in between that, they had really regular conversation that guys at diners would have. And it made the interaction between the characters more real. And I don't want, you know, spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen this. Go see this movie, but I won't spoil it. But the main betrayal between two characters in that movie was made more real because you saw how quickly they bonded in between planning this heist. You know, this kind of brotherhood, and that's a real guy thing that you could relate to at any age. Even the character in that group who came off as the most dastardly, who did the most unspeakable thing, dancing to Stuck in the Middle with You, and, you know, I won't get into it because I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but even when you look at what he did, and you're like, oh, that's awful, that's irredeemable, but he did it because of he was doing it from a good place to protect this band of brothers that he's formed, some that he's known for years, some that he met right away. But it was from a place of loyalty that he did something really, really awful. And we didn't get a lot of time to explain why he would be so loyal. A few flashbacks with, say, Chris Penn's character, him and Michael Madsen. You know, you learned how much they cared about each other because of the conversations they had when the bullets weren't firing. That's why I love that movie so much, because it was just real.
I think it's a real compliment to a director, screenwriter team when you can take a group of criminals and root for them.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the best example in history of film would be the Godfather films, the first two Godfather films particularly. You're rooting for the criminals in that case. You know, they're just protecting their family. That's how that whole thing is set up. But you're right, Tarantino takes it to a much edgier level, and you got to give him credit for that. You either have to like or dislike Tarantino's stuff. If you like it, the films are great.
So you're a big fan of most of Tarantino's movies?
Yeah, and there's no in-between, like you said. Either you love this guy or you're like, what the heck is wrong with this guy?
What do you think? I heard he's going to do a film about Charles Manson. He's going to do his take.
I'm going to get anything he says he's going to do, I will give him a chance. It's ridiculous. I'm like, really? That's what you want to do? As far as, and he's always teased, this might be my last film. If that is indeed his last film, man, but I always want to give this guy a chance because, again, the way he writes characters as far as how they interact with each other is probably some of my favorite stuff. Even when what they're talking about is awful or when they're hurling insults at each other, I just love the interaction. If you haven't seen The Hateful Eight, every interaction between Sam Jackson and Walton Goggins, who, shout out to Walton Goggins, one of my favorite underappreciated actors, they spent most of the movie hurling the most awful racially charged insults at each other, but you still understood where their relationship throughout the course of that film went because of how Tarantino set it up and wrote it. So I loved it. And another bonus note on why I love Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction so much is I talked about, this will come out in the early 90s. I'm 31. Shouldn't have been watching those movies when they dropped. I remember when my parents, you know, they own Reservoir Dogs on DVD. When they rented Pulp Fiction, I would wake up early on Saturday morning, which was cartoon time, as a kid, because I knew I wasn't supposed to watch those movies, but I knew they looked awesome to me. And I would put the VHS in, and I would sit super close to the TV with the volume all the way down and would listen to it through the speakers, because I knew if my mom and dad heard me listening to that, it was going to be a bad Saturday for Justin. But I would sneak and watch Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, and probably shouldn't have done that. I'm probably scarred for life in some way, but whatever. But
I think you came through it all right.
Yeah, I think I'm so far. But again, it's just a great memory of the first time I watched both of those movies, where it was almost these characters were doing awful things that they were trying to keep from the eye of the law, and I was doing the same thing. I was right there with them. I don't know what color I would have gotten if I was one of the misters. I'll go with Mr. Gold. I'm a Purdue guy, black and gold. So that would have been my moniker. So it was awesome.
It desensitized you for police reporting. So when you're a journalist at a scene, you've seen
exactly. Exactly. This is nothing compared to what I saw Tarantino do.
In the early 1980s, I did some reporting, police reporting, and part of the time it was IMPD. It was a different time. Mm-hmm. In those days, the robbery and homicide detectives would go out and talk to the press. Today, you're talking to a public information officer. So it was kind of nice just because they were trained in how to deal with the media, and sometimes they could answer questions the PIO officer doesn't have. It's not their fault. It's just they can't anticipate every question the media is going to have. I bring that up because I do think there is a desensitization you have to have. Police officers have to have it, and I would say police reporters. There's almost a kind of a gallows humor you have to do, and it's just a way to get through the day, because there's some, you mentioned it earlier, there's some pretty tough things that happen in a big city, and Indianapolis is a relatively large city, and we do have crime problems, and we know, I mean, I'm not going to get into why, you have a better feel for that, and I don't want to talk about that, but crime does so much become the center of our films in this day. Talk about that a little bit.
That's a good point. It really does. And it's weird because, you know, one of the reasons I'm so into all the, you know, stuff that I'm into, movies and comics, it's an escape because work is very real and it can be very tough. But like you said, there's this, I don't want to say fascination, but this desire to maybe understand crime a little bit more, so it becomes the central focus in all these movies. And think about every new TV show that comes out is some hour procedural that's either from the eyes of investigators or the criminals, and gosh, 90% of new shows are either reboots of crime shows or new crime shows. So again, this thing that we all agree is awful and we almost want to shield our eyes from, we still gravitate to it, almost maybe because we're trying to understand it or not be so shaken when it happens next door, if it ever does, God forbid. So maybe in a way it's us as, you know, a populace trying to cope with all the things that we see by watching these things to take some of the realness out of the crime, because when it shows up on the front page, that's one thing. But when it's on, you know, a movie poster, it's a way for us to say, all right, we can deal with it. We'll make it. So it's strange.
Let me change the subject a little bit here, because we're almost halfway through the year. Mm-hmm. Tell me, what are some of your favorite films, best films you have seen this year up to this point?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, my biggest surprise of the year, which I was already excited for it because I'm a big Edgar Wright head, Baby Driver is one of my favorite movies of the year so far. I'm also a big music head, so the way he was able to weave the soundtrack into the film was fantastic. Also really love the kid who played the main role. He's got a weird name, so it escapes me at the moment.
Engel Elmsgaard.
Yeah. Fantastic. By the way, he's also a heck of a singer. I didn't know he could sing as well as he does. I saw him on James Corden. Him and Jamie Foxx were having a sing-off. Amazing. But that's probably my surprise of the year. Absolutely loved what they did with that movie, and I recommend everyone go check it out. From the superhero aspect, Spider-Man Homecoming was a huge hit for me. I've loved Spider-Man, and I'm so glad they finally kind of got that character right in a lot of ways. Tobey Maguire, credit to you, man, but Tobey Maguire was like 47 trying to play a high schooler when that thing came out, and Mary Jane Watson was always, as a kid, portrayed to me as this impossibly attractive, super cool, you know, buxom redhead. And no disrespect to Kirsten Dunst, but that's not you. So it was cool to see my character finally on screen. And Spider-Man's such a – he's an easy guy to get wrong. Not a hard guy to get right, though. He just has to be a relatable superhero. And, you know, they finally did it with Tom Holland. This kid's super likable. And I was a little biased, too, because – I always loved Spider-Man, and he won me over in a lot of interviews he did. Tom Holland just introducing himself to the world. So those are probably two of my favorites, from one from the comic book realm and one from just a well-directed. I'm big on style. If you can put together a stylish movie that really captures me with some really good performances, you'll usually win my loyalty. And they did that with Baby Driver, for example. So this was some really fun stuff this year.
So I saw, I don't know if this is true now, you perform hip-hop?
I do. Also, music. I've been writing, rapping, producing, singing since, middle school. So I've been, you know, doing that, dabbling, doing shows since probably first real shows, opening up for people like back in high school, and been doing it ever since. Our biggest run, I guess, was through Purdue. Had a chance to do some really great shows and open for some really cool artists. And still working on it now. And, yeah, it's been really, really great.
What's your name?
Well, actually, I used to have a rap name. I retired that. All new music now is just going through my real name. But my rap name previously was JL. My initials are JLM, Justin Lester Mack. So my rap name was JL Miraculous. Miraculous was the, you know, that's was like the rap name was Miraculous, but JL Miraculous was the rap name before I retired it, because, you know, you got to look at it. Once you're 30, it's like, okay, rap name or nah. And I had to hang that in the rafters a little bit, retire the jersey.
So I, in high school, rapped like in the cafeteria with friends.
Oh, man.
And I had the worst rap name. The Caucasian Sensation.
Oh, Lord.
Okay, now you've got new material. A caramel kid and a friend's rapping.
But you know what, man? Lunchroom ciphers, rapping in school, like, that was our thing. Like, it would gather around on a lunch table.
Bang on the table.
Somebody would make a beat with, you know, the pen and pencil, and we would just rap, and either before school, after school, in the lockers, during football practice, during band practice, and I thrived on, you know, almost just, it was like battle rap, outwitting your opponent in a way. And I've always thankfully been quick on my feet as far as thinking of stuff. But the Caucasian Sensation, man, I would have ate your lunch. There's so much to work with.
Oh, I know.
Huge target, dog. Huge target.
Well, putting up that. So, you know, besides 8 Mile, which I think everyone mentions 8 Mile, is there really a good hip hop movie about rap that kind of truly talks about the culture?
Yeah, you have to go, man, there are great ones. Go back to Wild Style, go back to Breaking, go back to stuff like that, because that, it did it from the genesis of it. It was done with the care and love of the stewards of it, of hip-hop at the time, and to this day they stand up as great examples of, you know, the culture and everything it means. There's also a lot of movies that, for me, are rap movies that aren't necessarily about rap, because of, one, the culture they represent and the people involved with it. Like, a go-to movie that I think anybody who loves hip-hop will say is one of their favorite movies of all time is the movie Paid in Full. If you haven't seen Paid in Full, it's Mekhi Phifer, Wood Harris, and Cameron, the rapper, and they're retelling the real story of the Harlem gangsters, Rich Porter, Alpo. These are all, you know, it's kind of an adaptation, but it was so ingrained in the culture, hip hop culture, that it was, you know, again, saw it, totally blew my mind. And there's probably been a million rappers who have made, done music videos that are homages to Paid in Full. A movie like Belly that was, you know, starring DMX and Nas, who Nas is my favorite rapper of all time, directed by Hype Williams, who was a, you know, a rap music director. Again, that's a rap movie without it necessarily being about rap. So that's another thing, too, is that when you're trying to find a hip-hop movie, like you said, 8 Mile or a Breakin' or a Beat Street. Oh, gosh, Beat Street. Those are movies that are necessarily, those, you know, about the industry in a way, but it's so hard because a lot of what makes rap rap doesn't really have anything to do with getting signed or having a deal or anything like that. It's just about the culture itself, and those movies do a better job of kind of relaying that to people who are unfamiliar with it than a lot of movies that are about the music, which is why 8 Mile for me was, you know, a triumph because it got to the culture as far as, you know, what motivated Eminem's character to want to do that. But it also got a little bit about, you know, to the pursuit of trying to get on. So, yeah, those are, for me, great examples. But, yeah, history lesson for folks, Breaking, Beat Street, go see all those movies.
And I would throw in Hustle and Flow is a great film because I liked it.
I loved Hustle and Flow.
What I liked about it was his rapping was only okay. I mean, he was pretty good, but it really wasn't about how if he's the greatest rapper. It was about how he worked to get his studio and how to get everything going and all the behind the scenes things that comes to work as an artist and to make it happen. It's more than just actually being good rapper. You have to do all the other things in order to make it.
Exactly. And I think that's where rap differs and why I like the movies that talk about the culture and the lifestyles, because, you know, as a singer, usually if you're an amazing vocal talent, you can find writers. A lot of singers don't write their own stuff or necessarily have to, you know, communicate their lifestyle to get on. You know, a lot of singers are just singing love ballads. Well, rappers are expected to, you know, translate their reality onto pen and pad or onto a song. It's a whole different set of criteria.
Yeah, I think that rap, hip hop, if you listen to the words, they're really telling an important story that they didn't think anybody else was paying attention to.
Absolutely.
And it brought attention to that story of what life was like in some of these neighborhoods. And that really does dovetail into filmmaking, which again is telling a story. And when you do a story about rap and hip hop, you're telling the story of how people are trying to tell their own stories.
Yeah. And those stories are important because another thing too is someone who has written and produced both rap and, you know, R&B and soul and done singing and rapping, it's a lot easier to write, you know, an R&B song than a rap song. It just is. There's not as much required of you. And just in the matter of putting together, say, three verses or two verses in a bridge, there's not as much space to fill in an R&B or a soul song, whereas you can get away with repeating three or four words. James Brown has some of the greatest soul songs in the world, and that guy repeated a phrase for 4 minutes, and there you go. But you got 4 minutes in a rap song. You need to be saying something, or we're going to lose attention real quick. So,
I want to talk about your interest in film, because you was your interest in film, did it come about because you wanted to watch these films that your parents didn't want you to watch when you were younger? Or what drew you to this idea of watching film? What drew you to that?
For me, the big thing about film, and I watched a lot of film with my parents, my mother and father had very, very different tastes. My dad, for example, was big into almost flawed protagonists. One of his favorite movies and one of my favorite movies of all time is Cool Hand Luke. His nickname, I called him Cool Hand. That was his nickname. So it was one of those things that was, you know, those kind of films really got to him. And my mom was all about the whimsical side of things. She's was my partner as far as like comic books and all that stuff. I got that from mom. She was a huge comic book head and into all the different fantasy elements. And it was just about them almost showing that another way to be creative. Thankfully, I grew up in a really creative household. Everyone played instruments. Everyone did a little bit of something outside of just the daily grind. And it was their way of letting me know there's a lot of ways to express yourself creatively, and you don't have to limit your interests or your taste to any certain thing. So we watched a lot of film, and we had a lot of films in the house just because my parents wanted to make sure that, one, I had the freedom to see what I was into, because as a kid, you don't know what you like until you see it. And two is that, you know, these different escapes are almost ways that, okay, you can see that, and then this is the way you can express yourself. It was just a really cool, we were just always into that, and my mom probably had more books than anyone I've ever owned, and my dad, he was in construction, and he started off as a carpenter, ended up as a project manager, and was like probably a math whiz. This guy, he would look at these complex plans and figure out, you know, stuff, structures, so structures don't fall on people, stuff that was beyond me. But they both had different ways of looking at the world and said, you know what, maybe check out this film, look at The Escape and see what it inspires you to want, do, or be. And sometimes just look at that and take your mind away from some of the stuff that might be weighing you down. Find an outlet. I found maybe one too many outlets because I have too many interests. But you know what, that was always encouraged when I was growing up, so I'm always thankful for it.
So, first of all, you described yourself on, I think, on your Twitter as a nerd, which, you know, you feel like being in that. I don't know if even being into comic books is nerdy anymore.
Not anymore. It's you know, you almost have to find something. Comic books isn't even nerdy. It's just like the norm now. At the time when I was growing up, though, it was, you know, definitely a counterculture thing, and being into stuff like anime and being into, you know, deep into video games and stuff like that. But now it's just the norm. It's just everything.
Was it hard? So you love the source material, and it's really hard when you have such a love for the source material to see how it translates to the big screen. On the plane, when I went to my trip recently, I watched Ghost in the Shell.
Oh, don't talk about it.
It was, if you know, familiar with the source material, this was not very good. It was Scarlett Johansson, you know, based on a, you know, anime, and just, it did not turn out very well. And a lot of people criticized because they tried to make Scarlett Johansson look Asian. Mm-hmm. And they thought, well, why don't you just get an Asian actress for that role?
Exactly. And that's the thing, too, is for me, which is frustrating as someone who loves anime, and, you know, Ghost in the Shell, along with Akira, are probably the two most important anime films of all time. Akira probably is definitely in my top five movies of all time. These films already exist. Why do we need to make a live-action version? And I don't know if
money.
It's money, but at the time, and I think that's almost what's frustrating for a lot of anime fans, is that these films exist. They're full-length features. They're wonderfully directed and planned and executed. But it's almost like, well, it's not live-action, so it needs more validity. We need to actually have a live-action version because this is just a cartoon. But what they don't understand, and I think the Ghost in the Shell comparatives is the easiest way to see that, it's a cartoon, but what they did as far as telling a story and creating likable characters and story arcs and actually making a statement was possible in that cartoon that you write off. But in this live action, they just totally missed the mark, and it didn't mean anything. It was just like Scarlett Johansson playing almost a subdued version of her Black Widow character with a bad wig on. And they just stripped the soul of everything we loved about Makoto Kusanagi, that character. It was rough. And I was upset also because when I saw that movie as a kid, this was, you know, female empowerment in every sense of the word. The whiniest character was the big burly guy that was, you know, Major Kusanagi's partner, who just couldn't get around the fact that, oh, I'm an android, why am I so sad? And in a way she said, suck it up, look at all we have to be thankful for, we're amazing, we're awesome. And the climax of that film wasn't a gunfight or fighting robots, which there was a great robot fight, but the climax of that movie was the main character having a discussion with the antagonist and them coming to an understanding. That was the climax of the Ghost in the Shell anime. Two people having a conversation who started off not knowing each other and hating each other from what they heard, not hating each other, but having a mission to destroy one another. And in the end, they had a talk. That was the movie. And then Scarlett Johansson said, okay, let's blow stuff up and shoot and jump out of windows. You know, the depth and everything that was in that cartoon didn't exist in the live action.
Yeah, people don't realize animation actually gives you, as a filmmaker and a storyteller, a little bit more freedom. You can do things in that animation platform you might find difficult or impossible to do in a live action film. Yep. So you make a great point. One last question, Adam.
All right. I got other things to ask, but since it's the last question, what is a movie you're looking forward to coming out?
Oh, man. That's a great question. Well, you know what? As the superhero thing blows up all over the world, probably my most anticipated movie is Black Panther. To see what they do with that movie, and credit to Marvel, they've taken a lot of, you know, kind of tertiary characters and turned them into the biggest drawing things. To think that Guardians of the Galaxy would probably be the second most popular franchise behind the Avengers in their stable, and to think that somebody as you couldn't put on screen as Deadpool would have turned out to be the R-rated blockbuster that it was. I'm really loving where we are as far as, you know.
They picked a great director in Ryan Coogler.
Exactly. Ryan Coogler, and that cast is amazing. And again, as a black kid growing up being into that kind of stuff, the representation just really wasn't there in a lot of ways. And, you know, to see not only are they taking this character who is an amazing character, not only because he has really cool powers and an awesome suit and is rumored to be able to whip Captain America in a fist fight, he was always kind of heralded as being just extremely intelligent and just, you know, really being an awesome hero from so many aspects and having, like, family at the root of his character. And that cast, you know, again, it's something that shouldn't have to be said, but it's a big deal to have this character that is a strong black character be represented in a cast that is made up of strong black actors. And these are not, like, you know, light actors. This is, you know...
Michael B.
Jordan's the man. Lupita Nyong'o is amazing. Think about the people that they're bringing into
Oscar
direct
winner,
and
Forrest
be
Whitaker.
In this. You know what I mean? it's something that I can't help but be extremely excited for. And just as an action flick, look at those trailers. You can't tell me, other than Thor Ragnarok, no one has produced better superhero trailers than this Black Panther movie so far. And it's I'm really hoping the response is going to be positive. Unfortunately, you know, you have to brace for some negative response. Just like when Wonder Woman was coming out, you knew you had to brace for some negative response. It was there. Unfortunately, there's going to be maybe a handful of people who are upset. They're already, oh, there's so many black characters in this movie. It's Black Panther.
It's set in Wakanda. It's set in Africa.
What are you supposed to do? How could you be upset about that?
But nobody's, those same people weren't upset about having all white,
exactly.
Cast, so, when there could have been an African-American person in it. So it's, yeah.
It's crazy to me, but that's probably the movie I'm the most excited for because it really intersects so many things that I didn't think I would ever see as a kid who was into this stuff. Not only to see it grow, but to see this character given such a huge platform and such a huge opportunity to let people know that you don't have to be bothered by this. So that's probably what I'm the most excited for.
Well, Adam's already said he has plenty more questions, so we'll have to have you back, Justin. I hope you'll agree to come back and talk to us again.
Anytime. Talking is definitely not something I have trouble doing. There's a lot of great film in the way. I'd love to have a recap with you guys down the line.
Well, good luck with your work at the Indie Star and The Drop. You can pick it up at theindiestar.com.
Yep.
If you want to watch The Drop, it's a daily video production.
Mm-hmm.
And don't miss it if you follow Indianapolis area news at all. Justin, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you.
This has been the weekly podcast, Hamilton County Goes to the Movies, originating from Donatello's Italian Restaurant in downtown Carmel. This week, Adam and I gave high grades to our movies reviewed, Dunkirk and The Big Sick. Dunkirk is a very intense war film that may not be for everyone, but The Big Sick is a comedic look at relationships in modern America that should appeal to most everyone. Our thanks to Justin Mack of the Indianapolis Star. You can go to IndyStar.com to find his regular video series, The Drop. Adam and I will be back next week. We post a new podcast each Saturday. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again.